Chapter 46 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 46. I have already said all I want to say about my trial and conviction at the Old Bailey for libelling Winston Churchill. I was sentenced to 6 months in the Second Division. The Second Division confers no privileges, except in the matter of writing and receiving letters and visits. One a month is the allowance in each case. Apart from that, a prisoner in the Second Division might just as well be sentenced to simple imprisonment or imprisonment with hard labour. The labour is the same in every case. When I was in prison, I was put to work for the first 10 days in the shed to sew mail bags. After that, I was transferred to the garden. There were about 15 of us gardeners. Some were Second Division, and others were hard labour. We all did exactly the same work. So if the hard labour people were doing hard labour, so was I. Part of the work we did was filling carts with coal and then dragging the carts. This swinging a shovel is fairly hard work, and I did my share of it, although the officer who looked after the gardeners, a charming and kindly fellow named Belcher, told me that I did not need to do it if it overtired me. My natural desire was to do the same as everyone else did, and if I had had enough to eat, my work in the garden, which conferred the privileges of being in the open air for 5 or 6 hours a day, without a hat in all weathers, this was in December and January, would have done me no harm at all. But unfortunately, starved as I was and weak for want of food, it caused internal injuries from which I have never recovered. I have already described my reception at Wormwood Scrubs in 1914. When I went again in 1923, on 13th of December, everything was just the same. I was worn out and sick when I reached the prison. I think I ought to have been sent straight to hospital. However, I did not say anything about how ill I felt, and the doctor did not notice it, and I spent 7 weeks, during which I was nearly starving, in the ordinary prison, getting weaker and weaker, because I could not eat the food. For the first 2 weeks I ate nothing but the crusts of the bread, and drank the half pint of weak cocoa in the evening. The last meal was at 4 o'clock, nothing more after that till next day's breakfast. I believe I would have died if the deputy governor, who was always very kind and pleasant to me, had not happened to pass close to me one day in the garden. He stopped and said, "You are looking frightfully ill. You must report to the doctor." I said, "Oh, I don't know. I don't feel any worse than usual." He went away, and next day the doctor sent for me and had me weighed. Evidently I had lost a lot of weight, because he asked me about the food. I asked how much weight I'd lost, but they would not tell me. I had by this time gone on the vegetarian diet, because it was slightly less nauseating than the other, but except for a tiny piece of cheese, very nasty but eatable, and a sort of pudding which came 3 times a week and had a slight suspicion of sweetness about it, there was scarcely anything I could eat. The doctor doubled my allowance of cheese and cocoa and pudding. Then I was weighed again in a few days, but my weight was still going down rapidly. He said, "You must go into the hospital. I can't give you any more to eat outside the hospital because I am tied by the regulations, but if you go to hospital you will get good food and plenty of it." I was only too glad to go, and by that time I was so weak that the officer who took me across had to put his arm round me to hold me up. It shows what a state of collapse I was in that I remember being filled with horror and apprehension, because, when I got to the hospital, there was a cat standing at the door with a mouse in its mouth. I dislike mice very much, and I had never seen a sign of one in my cell in Hall B, number 69, to my great relief. So when I saw the cat, I remembered that someone had told me that there were swarms of mice in the hospital. I said to the officer, "Will there be mice in my ward?" He said, "Well, there might be, but you needn't mind them, they won't hurt you." People never can understand that one's dislike to mice is not connected with any apprehension that they may be liable to bite one. I was frozen with horror. I thought to myself, if the place is going to be full of mice, it will just about finish me. When I was left alone, I prayed desperately to St. Anthony of Padua to keep mice away from me. It is the extraordinary fact that I never saw one again, or heard the slightest sound of one the whole time I was in the hospital, though other prisoners told me that the place was full of them. The hospital has two floors. There are wards with beds in them, just like ordinary hospital wards, and there are also rows of separate cells. The wards are airy and cheerful, and the cells are much less forbidding than the cells in the ordinary prison. They have much larger windows, which you can look out of without standing on a chair, and the hospital itself is pleasantly situated in the garden of the prison. When I got into a private cell, with its green walls and a little cot, actually with real sheets and a pillow, I began to feel better. The food seemed too delicious to be real. It was just ordinary roast beef or roast mutton and rice pudding, but, starving as I was, it seemed like ambrosia. I also got half a pint of milk a day and some real bread. There was no butter, only margarine, which I never would eat, so I preferred my bread dry. I was horrified, after I had been in hospital about 3 weeks, to gather from something the doctor said on one of his visits that when my weight got back to normal, I would have to go back to Hall B. I was so much less wretched in my cell in the hospital that the idea of going back to starvation gave me cold shivers. I again had recourse to St. Anthony, and though I was weighed every week, and though I really was fed up and had plenty of good food, I never anywhere near got back my weight, and I stayed in the hospital right to the day of my release. For the last 6 weeks in prison, I used to play the American organ in the Catholic chapel at Mass and benediction. This was a treat, as it gave me a little variation from the deadly monotony. We used to have choir practices, which were rather amusing. The choir chiefly consisted of a few Borstal boys and a sprinkling of Sinn Feiners. I was very friendly with the Sinn Feiners. Although I had been so anti-Sinn Fein, I felt very sorry for them and sympathetic, as they were Catholics, gentlemen, and political offenders. I thought it very unjust that they should be treated as ordinary prisoners. Some of them had frightful sentences, as long as 12 or 18 months. One of them, McGrath, a very nice fellow, looked terribly ill when I went out. I told them just before I left to cheer up, as I was going to get them out. When I got out, I wrote to the Home Secretary about them. It was while the Labour government were in power, so logically, as I told the Home Secretary, they had no right whatever to object to Sinn Feiners. It was, I dare say, a mere coincidence that directly after that they were transferred to Brixton as political offenders and put in the 1st Division, which, compared with the 2nd Division, is simply luxury, as you can have your own clothes and food. A few weeks later they were let out altogether. So, even if I had no part in securing their release, I certainly brought them luck. I was very friendly with Art O'Brien, one of the Sinn Feiners, and when I went out, I smuggled a letter from him to his sister. Father Musgrave, the Catholic chaplain, was very kind to me, and it was, of course, he who made me organist as soon as the other prisoner who played the organ finished his sentence and went out. There was one extraordinary old chap in the choir who had been in prison altogether, on and off, for 29 years. He fancied himself as a solo singer and sang the solo part in Regina Laetare at Easter. He also had his own ideas as to how the hymns ought to be sung, which frequently differed from the way they were scored in my hymn book. I played them as they were written, but he said I was wrong, and Father Musgrave said, "Never mind, play it his way. It's a tradition of the prison." However, one day Father Musgrave himself remonstrated with him and said he was wrong, whereupon he replied, "Excuse me, Father, I've been 29 years in prison, and if I don't know how to sing these hymns, I don't know who should." While Father Musgrave was away for a time, owing to illness, his place was taken by a Carmelite from Church Street, Kensington, Father 40, who also showed me the greatest possible kindness. A friend of mine, Mr. Rose, bully-ragged the Home Secretary into giving me permission to have writing materials, on the ground that I was a distinguished poet, and that it was outrageous to deprive me of the means of exercising my art. Accordingly, I was given a school copybook, as supplied to Borstal boys, and a pencil. I felt that it was up to me to write something, as my friend had been to so much trouble. So I wrote a sonnet with considerable difficulty. I had no intention of writing any more, but one day I had another shot and produced another sonnet, and then again a third. Quite accidentally, they hung together, and I conceived the idea of writing a long poem all in sonnets. I worked hard at it, invoking St. Anthony and St. Thomas Aquinas whenever I got stuck, and produced the 17 sonnets which make up my poem In Excelsis, which appeared in the London Mercury and was afterwards published by Martin Secker. A week before I came out of prison, I started saying it to myself every night in bed, so as to get it by heart. It was fortunate that I did this, as the Home Office, for reasons best known to itself, confiscated my copybook 2 days before I left prison, and have refused to give it back to me, though I have twice asked them to reconsider their decision. Prison is terrible beyond belief. It makes me indignant to read letters and articles from people who talk about coddling prisoners. I would like to give such people, and also most of the judges on the bench, just what I had in the second division, 6 months, which, with remission marks, is really only 5 months. It is unrelieved misery all the time. I was better off in the hospital because I had enough to eat, and was allowed as many books as I wanted. But, on the other hand, I was soon ill from want of air and exercises. You are not obliged to do any work in hospital, but many do it to kill time. It is awful to be locked up for 22 hours, sometimes 23 hours, out of every 24, in a tiny cell. Each day is like a month. Time passed much quicker before I went to the hospital. If I could have had the food I had in hospital, combined with the fresh air and exercise I got in the garden, I would not have complained. But it was a choice between starving on the one hand and claustration in a kennel on the other. In a ward, you may be worse off than in a cell. Just before I left prison, during the last week in fact, I had a return of the unreasoning panic I had had 9 years before in Wormwood Scrubs. I thought they would not let me out. I was bound over in addition to my imprisonment, and up to the last minute the governor received no word from the Home Office about the acceptance of my surety, Sholto Douglas again. I could see that the governor was worried about it on my behalf, and this terrified me. Finally, the governor said, "You had better write to the Home Office yourself." I did. I implored them not to torture me further, and to send word that I was to be released on the day my sentence expired. This produced the desired result, but I was in agonies to the last day. It took me 2 years to get over the effects of my imprisonment. Soon after I got out, I went abroad, first to Bruges and then to Brussels. I was very ill at both places, and suffered from a kind of blood poisoning, which was due to starvation and other things. I am nearly well now, apart from the internal injury. There is really nothing more to tell of my life, which at present appears to have settled into a placid groove. When I had somewhat recovered from the effects of my imprisonment, I went abroad a second time with my son Raymond, who was for a short time in the Scots Guards. We had a very pleasant time in Monte Carlo and various places in France. About this time I began to notice, more particularly, that the attitude of society, speaking generally, had changed towards me. All of a sudden, everyone I met, wherever I went, began to be kind and amiable. This was entirely due to the sympathy which my imprisonment and sufferings aroused. The English are like that. They have very little imagination, and they will go on behaving in a perfectly brutal way for years to a man, not out of ill nature, for really, they are the most good-hearted and kindly people au fond, but simply, as I say, from want of imagination, and because they have never taken the trouble to find out the facts about the man in question for themselves, but have been hypnotized by parrot cries and mass suggestion. Then, one day, insensibly, the scale tips in the other direction, probably as the result of a long process whose details are hidden in obscurity. I suppose the two main reasons why I've been so unkindly and harshly treated in England are that I'm a Scotsman and that I'm a poet. The English do not understand the Scots. They call them mean, which is the most ludicrous libel, for the Scots, man for man, are far more generous and more hospitable, and more inclined to stick up for the underdog and to fight for lost causes, supreme test of generosity, than the English. Their attitude towards the Stuarts shows this. They went on being Jacobites and fighting and dying for the Stuarts long after the English had got to the stage of denouncing as traitors and hanging and otherwise persecuting anyone who continued to uphold the claims of his lawful sovereign. My own direct ancestor, Sir John Douglas, was the only Douglas who was out on the right side in the 45 Jacobite Rising, and was imprisoned for 2 years in the Tower, and narrowly escaped being hanged. Also, the English hate poets, as long as they're alive. I mean real poets, of course. They love sham poets, and persons who recite little things of their own in drawing rooms. But when real poets die, the English begin to appreciate them and to get sentimental about them. This sometimes happens even while the poet is still alive. After abusing and persecuting a poet for the greater part of his lifetime, they sometimes end by being quite nice, to use the universal English word, to him and about him. I rather hope they will go on being nice to me, for I admit that I am a little weary of my 30 years' war, and I am not disinclined to take a rest and to bid farewell to the arena. The only thing that would get me out again would be another paper of my own, and that seems quite beyond the reach of probability. End of chapter 46.